15. Judges Smith and Gaetis join me, Judge Sleater, the presiding judge. Our case number two on the docket, A210924, Mark D. Island et al. Appellants versus Jason D. Ferguson, respondent, Mesa Underwriters Specialty Insurance Company, also respondent. And if I heard correctly, Mr. Lulick, did I understand you will be solely providing a response, or who did I have it backward? Respondent, there's two parties, and I just want to know who's arguing for respondents and how much time, if you've decided to divide time between yourselves.
Good morning, Your Honor. I will be arguing, Joe Lulick, I will be arguing on behalf of Mesa. Mr. Waldeck and I have agreed to split the time allowed between us.
Okay, thank you. So we'll note that what the marshal will do is simply set 7.5 minutes then initially for whichever counsel goes first, and then you'll see the time expire, and then we'll set it again for the other counsel as well. We do ask counsel to identify yourself for the record before you begin your comments, and you will see the clock in the corner. If we lose you at any time, we'll reconnect, and the clock will stop, of course, until we're reconnected. And I'll just note also that any recording, separate recording of this proceeding is disallowed because of the our recording of it, and it will be available on the branch website within 24 hours. So, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is John Giesen. I represent the appellants, Grinnell Mutual and Mark Island. The Supreme Court could not be more emphatic. The failure to draw all reasonable inferences in a non-moving party's favor requires reversal of summary judgment. The question presented by this appeal is whether the adverse inference arising from the destruction of evidence is a reasonable inference that district courts must draw. In this case, the district court failed to view the circumstantial evidence of negligence in the non-moving party's favor, and also failed to draw that available adverse inference arising from respondents' destruction of the fire scene. For that reason, we'd ask this court to reverse. I'd like to address the issues in somewhat reverse order than they were briefed. I'd like to start with, I believe, the fact issues raised by Ferguson's response brief. Ferguson takes the somewhat surprising position that digging through the fire scene with a payloader and picking out all of the scrap metal did not disturb the fire scene. Frankly, that assertion is not supported by the record. This is a payloader we're talking about. This is a piece of heavy equipment. The testimony was that the scrap metal was removed, and Ferguson himself testified that the fire scene was disturbed. The standard of review here does not give Ferguson the luxury of ignoring his own deposition testimony. For purposes of summary judgment, the fire scene was disturbed. Second, somewhat related point is that Grinnell was not hindered access to the fire scene, according to Mr. Ferguson.
Mr. Giesen, before you get into that, just one question, though. Is the critical issue whether there's spoliation of evidence in particular as opposed to the scene? In other words, I don't believe there's much dispute that when you dig a payloader into the what essentially was left of basement and start digging things out, that the scene is disturbed. But how does that connect to the presence of spoliation of evidence in particular?
The scene is the evidence. And in particular, the relation of all of the pieces of the stove in relation to other evidence. Fire scene experts, when they go into a scene, as you can see from Selective's expert, they go and look at how the damage is most severe in certain areas. They look at what pieces are damaged. You know, I'm not a fire scene investigator, but Grinnell's investigator said because the fire scene was disturbed, it made it near impossible for him to reach any meaningful conclusion. Notably, Selective did not allow the payloader digging to happen before their investigation. They made sure it only happened before Grinnell's. And I think Your Honor made the comment that nobody's disputing that the payloader digging through the fire scene didn't disturb anything. I didn't think that was disputed, but Ferguson actually raises that assertion in his response brief. So I just wanted to make that clear. This wasn't a surgical operation that was done with delicacy or discretion. This was a payloader digging through the critical evidence in this case. And coupled with that, you have the testimony of Grinnell's expert that destruction of the fire scene prevented him from doing his job.
Can I ask, so, the I mean, the theory of the case is that there was negligence around, theory of your case is that there's negligence around the stove, operation of the stove, right?
Generally, yes.
The stove was the cause of the fire and there was negligence around its operation. Is that right?
Based on discovery, yes. Our complaint alleges that the fire was negligently allowed to spread to our building and destroy it. And in discovery, based on the claims file that was produced, we discovered Selective's investigation, which pointed to additional circumstantial evidence that they believed that this stove was the most promising lead. And only after deciding that this stove was the most promising lead, decided to make sure that Grinnell never got the chance to conduct a meaningful investigation.
And so apropos of the idea of spoliation, what is it in the record besides being able to look and see, oh, maybe it was the wiring, maybe it was something else that actually isn't the stove, isn't your theory of the case. What is it that impaired your client's ability to prove that the stove and its operation and, you know, whatever else you say caused, I think it spread, which I think was around the stove theory, that there was spoliation of that evidence? In other words, did your investigator, your client's investigator, say they were unable to ascertain anything about the stove?
Yes. The testimony from our expert was that there were some pieces of the stove left, but he wasn't sure where they were located in relation to the fire scene, if that was still the same, or if there were other pieces missing. Essentially, everything got blended together, and the blended fire scene was not the same evidentiary quality as an unblended fire scene. You know, maybe to provide a different example, if in discovery, you're supposed to provide your files in the course they're, you know, the way they're ordinarily kept. If you're to shuffle all of your files and then provide them, the evidentiary value of that is decreased. And that's what happened here. The experts need to rule out other causes. And to do that, you need to see how the fire scene actually was in the aftermath of the fire. So our expert testified, yes, there were pieces of the fire stove or the pellet stove left, but that's not enough. Everything was blended because a payloader dug through the fire scene. And from that, because the fire scene, the critical evidence in this case, was destroyed, Minnesota law and the common law tradition long before Minnesota even became a state is that the jury is entitled to presume the worst. That's the case of the chimney sweeper's drool. It goes way back. That is a reasonable inference as a matter of law. And we picked this up in our response or our reply brief. We don't need a spoliation sanction in order to argue to the jury which inferences are reasonable. That's the jury's job to decide what inferences to draw. True, in criminal cases, you are more limited by constitutional concerns about arguing adverse inferences. But we point this court to the Supreme Court's decision in the Nicollet versus Connolly Hotel, or I might be butchering the name of that case. But it's very clear that we don't need a spoliation sanction in order to argue that the destruction of inference has evidentiary weight. And it's not just, I mean, we don't need evidence of bad faith, but there's plenty of that here too. We pointed to the evidence of the phone calls. We also pointed to the professional standards that govern. Selective admitted that professional standards require, that bind them, require them to not hoard access to the fire scene and also to reach out to other interested parties. They didn't follow those standards. Instead, you have the evasive testimony from Selective refusing to deny that this was a conscious effort to cut off exposure to third-party claims. So we believe this was a bad faith effort. You don't need to find bad faith in order to argue the adverse inference, but it's there. This is a well-known problem in the insurance industry. And I think we're entitled to argue to the jury and explain this all to them. And based on that information, the jury will be entitled to draw an adverse inference. And that takes
me to... Yeah.
Oh, excuse
Go
me.
Go ahead.
I just wondered, can you please state if the jury was instructed you may draw an adverse inference, what is the adverse inference that you are saying should be drawn?
That the fire scene evidence, if preserved, would be unfavorable to respondents. That's, you know, we didn't request that as a spoliation sanction. The spoliation sanction we request is that judgment as a matter of law be entered in our favor because they destroyed the critical evidence in this case. We didn't appeal the district court's decision not to grant us that relief, but we very clearly argued that the summary judgment versus spoliation sanction are different questions, and that at a minimum or in the alternative, even if that spoliation sanction requested was not granted, that we should nevertheless get our day in court because the critical
evidence. Is it that they could infer that the stove was operated negligently? I'm wondering what they're precisely supposed to infer from it.
It's a difficult question, because unfortunately we never got the chance to look at it. So we don't know exactly what the jury would be able to infer, but they can infer as a general matter, because the evidence was not preserved and not produced, which an honest and therefore fearless claimant would do, that it is unfavorable to them. Even if you can't pinpoint exactly why or what is wrong with the fire scene, the fact that it was destroyed hastily is a sign of guilt.
Mr. Gason,
excuse me.
Well, if you hadn't finished answering Judge Smith's go ahead and finish.
I think I finished. Yeah, I finished response. There's no pinpoint. We can't be required to pinpoint exactly what the destroyed evidence would show because the evidence is destroyed.
That's part of my question is that I'm still not sure I understand. The district court seemed to make it pretty clear from the court's perspective, looking at the record, that there was no evidence of there's no evidence that was destroyed, there was no lack of access, no evidence that was destroyed related to your client's claim. And it sounds to me like, and then so we had the two experts that looked at the stove, looked at the scene, we've got, and the parties were communicating, at least your client with Mesa, as I understand it. And then there was the decision then on the 30th, I think it was of April, if I understand the dates correctly, after your client looked at it on the 25th to then do the digging. And even that didn't completely dig up the pellet stove itself, as I understand. But what I'm trying to get at is what evidence in the record specifically would be evidence in favor of your client, or is it simply your client is claiming we wanted another view of it before they dug it up? And if that's the case, was that ever verbalized, or is that in the record, and that therefore they ignored that and quickly dug it up so that you wouldn't have a chance to go back another time?
I believe that is clearly in the record. We insisted that we have a chance to look at this fire scene. And as Discover revealed, the pellet stove was the main concern of Selective. They investigated, they determined that there was a teenager manipulating this active source of fire at midnight 30, the end of the shift. The only reason they cut this investigation short was not for any substantive reason. It's because they determined that they had no subrogation ability. They determined the statute of repose barred their claim against the pellet stove manufacturer. I believe that's very probative evidence that they thought something was wrong with this pellet stove. There was no other reason that would be the target of the investigation unless they themselves believed that something was wrong here. Coupled with that,
you said a teenager manipulating. My understanding in the record, the teenager poured pellets into it. He was 18, right? And that was something he did. And that's what the record shows, that he would, part of his job, and this happened between 11 and midnight, is to pour pellets into the stove before leaving for the night.
That's correct. And look at the case of Fenwick. I think that's the most closely applicable case on point. Ferguson's response brief, strikingly similar to this court's opinion in Fenwick. They pointed, look, you have no evidence that this teenage driver had a bad driving history. Without pointing to this particular dangerousness of this teenage driver, no jury question. Supreme Court reversed. They held, because of life experience, common sense, it's not remote or attenuated to look at the circumstantial evidence and decide that this particular combination of circumstances led to a foreseeable risk of harm. Manipulating or changing active source of fire, the end of a shift, it's a time when things don't tend to get done the reasonable care that sometimes might be done. Obviously we wanted more than what we have. We wanted an expert to go and look at the scene. Fortunately, Selective made sure we never got the chance. We tried to set up several calls. They understood, look at the claims file. They understood that we wanted access to the fire scene. Yet they send this phone call promptly back to Ferguson and tell him, unless there's a cease and desist order, a TRO, he's free to destroy the fire scene. This was a conscious effort, as testified by Grinnell's expert, to eliminate exposure to third-party claims. Regardless, they had a duty to preserve the evidence, because they failed to produce it, a jury could reasonably infer that it was not in their favor. I think this makes it a much clearer case. In Fenrick, imagine if the student driver absconded before trial. Or imagine in the Staub case, if the resort took a payloader to the staircase before anybody could look at it. That takes what may be a close case into a whole other level. All we're asking for is that their destruction of the evidence should have consequences. If they want to destroy the critical evidence in this case, they have to live with the evidentiary consequences of that decision. When you take the circumstantial evidence, including their own investigation, paired with their unexplained and I believe inexplicable destruction of the evidence, a jury could reasonably infer that this prior spread as a result of negligence. We should be entitled to our day in court, and we would ask this court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Gieson, and you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and the marshal will set the clock for 7.5 minutes, and whichever counsel is proceeding first for respondents, very well. Mr. Waldeck, you may identify yourself for the record and proceed. Yeah, you're still on mute, Mr. Waldeck.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. I'm Peter Waldeck here on behalf of respondent Jason Ferguson. I'll deal with appellant's arguments here in the same order. I think context is important. This was a fire that created a total loss of the two properties, my client's property and Mr. Island's property, the neighboring property, which Grinnell insures. The evidence is clear. In fact, not only did the fire destroy both buildings, the action to put out the fire by the fire department also did that. They had to bring in, I believe it was a backhoe. They had to collapse walls and basically collapse these buildings in on themselves to put out the fire. So what we were left with was a pile of rubble. That was on March 11th. On March 13th, all parties, including the fire state fire inspector, as well as representatives from Grinnell, came and inspected the scene. Grinnell inspected their insured scene and could view our property next door. Now, it's a pile of rubble. It's not exactly clear where everyone was. But the point is, the evidence, if the scene is the evidence, the fire and the fire suppression itself would have destroyed or altered that evidence. Now, the subsequent investigations by the fire marshal, as well as by Grinnell, if you want to consider it destroying evidence, I got the Grinnell, Dwight Duncan, their fire investigator, to admit he walked on Mr. Island's property and would have moved things slightly. I don't believe that that's a destruction of evidence. That's a necessary act in going in to look at these things. You're going to have to move things, remove the debris. So to claim that
counsel, if I may, isn't there at least a dispute of fact as to whether Grinnell had access to Mr. Ferguson's property before it was altered, you know, by the payload working, et cetera, that they actually called, wanted access to it, and wanted to actually be on site and investigate that, but that there were changes that were made after the fire was put out and before Mr. Duncan was able to access the property?
Okay, so I want to answer it directly, but I think it's important that we understand again the context here. So the evidence is that as of April 10th, my client removed a marble bench from the property. Now that's just a day under a month after this fire loss. So Grinnell essentially sat on their hands, and at no point during that time did they go to my client and request access to the property whatsoever.
Now, so you're also distinguishing between your client and the insurer, because they did ask the insurer for access, did they not?
They did ask the insurer for access, and that was never decisively determined one way or another. Essentially, at some point, Mesa said, listen, on April 4th, I believe they said, we're releasing the property back to Mr. Ferguson. We have no more interest. We're not going to undertake the expense and effort to try to investigate any further. We're done. It wasn't until late April that Grinnell actually contacted my client and he gave them free access to the property. Now, the issue really is this pellet stove. Grinnell got to inspect the pellet stove. They got to inspect unfettered access to the property. They could have requested the pellet stove. They never did. They could have requested that we do nothing else to alter the property.
Are you saying, though, that the only evidence of the change of what happened is the just going in and removing one marble, something rather? What about the payloader, et cetera?
I mean, the evidence is the payloader helped drag out this marble bench. And beyond telling you that, I can't tell you any more specifics of, I mean, I can envision in my mind what that looks like. I assume that property would have been moved, but it's clear in Mr. Ferguson's deposition that the metal wasn't removed until 2 days before the demolition occurred on April 30th. And we know that.
Why wouldn't it matter, though? I mean, I think that the defense from the defendants here would be, we don't know, the cause of the fire is undetermined. We don't know what happened. You haven't proved the case that it related to the stove. And why wouldn't the entire undisturbed scene be relevant to a plaintiff to be able to actually pinpoint? We can tell from the entire scene that the focus is on the stove because of, you know, the absence of fire marks elsewhere, et cetera. So why wouldn't all of the entire scene be relevant to help the plaintiff determine the locus and then perhaps the cause then of the start of the fire?
Well, the state fire investigator investigated and could not determine where the fire started, first and foremost. Second of all, as I said, the state fire investigator, his inspection, as well as the fire suppression, all this evidence was altered. I mean, it's not as if you would come into the building as it existed before the fire. In fact, the pellet stove itself was found in the basement. It was located
right. Might be arguments to make to a jury or a fact finder, but I'm wondering why on summary judgment.
Because they're grasping at straws. I mean, they don't have any evidence of our negligence other than we had an 18-year-old working, an 18-year-old who obviously could go to war for this country, have children, teach in a school. Somehow that's evidence of negligence. That's it. They're somehow claiming that we destroyed some type of evidence. They haven't identified what evidence we destroyed. They believe it's the pellet stove. The pellet stove was there to observe, for them to take, for them to study. They chose not to. They photographed it, they measured it, they looked at it, and they said, we don't need to do anything more. They ended their investigation. So I don't know what more they claim they would look at or need to look at or investigate to determine, but the stove was there. As far as the pile of rubble, how were they going to, the fire scene was destroyed before anybody got there by the fire and by the fire department. So to the extent that things are altered, this isn't CSI Las Vegas or whatever one they're on now. They don't get to come in and lift prints and do forensic evaluation. It is literally a pile of rubble that's dangerous.
Right, but that assumes that that the state fire investigator, once the fire has happened, could never determine a cause of fire because the fire has already happened and there's been change. I'm sure it happens, but clearly it also happens that the after fire and after there's destruction from putting out the fire, that the cause of the fire can be determined. I'm sure.
Well, the fire investigator said that's not the case.
Right. I'm sure it happens abstractly, though. It could happen in another case. The mere fact of there being a fire can't eliminate the ability to determine the cause of the fire.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible Grinnell started the fire. I would be grasping at straws to make that argument. They don't have, it's too attenuated. There's just nothing there. It was investigated. They had a chance. They waited for over a month, really a month and a half, to go out and look at this. And somehow they're blaming us. Now, can you imagine if kids got onto that property and injured themselves, what the claim against my client, once the property was released to him, what would the claim against him be for leaving that in the middle of a town? In the middle of a town. Now, the other thing is there's no bad faith destruction of evidence. Mr. Island, who was a named party, lives down the block. This was in Town Square. When we removed the bench, it was open and obvious for everyone to see. I see my time has expired, so I will just end it there unless you need me to answer any more questions. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Waldeck. And counsel for Mesa, you may identify yourself and you may proceed for 7.5 minutes.
Good morning, members of the court, counsel. I'm Joseph Lulick. I represent Mesa in this case. My first argument is based on the fact that the appellants in their brief, opening brief, state no claim against Mesa. The statement of the case of the appellants and the issues presented by appellants in their opening brief do not state a cause of action against Mesa. The two issues raised are whether or not there is circumstantial evidence of negligence. Well, whether there is or not would have no effect on the grant of summary judgment in favor of Mesa and against the plaintiffs. Mesa could not possibly have been negligent in this case. It is the insurer of Ferguson who is the building owner and operator. The second issue raised is whether or not there could be an adverse inference drawn as a result of destruction of evidence. And as Judge Smith pointed out, what this adverse inference is hard to get at and hard to determine. Whatever the adverse inference would be, it can have no effect at all on the liability here or the grant of summary judgment in favor of Mesa Underwriters.
Why couldn't the adverse inference be that the stove was a likely locus of the start of the fire, and that, you know, if the stove was doesn't appear to have a defect in its operation, it probably involved the way it was operated?
Well, it could be, but I don't think that is a proper adverse inference, because it's too attenuated. It's too distant from any evidence to support it. Your Honor, we can't say that the fire scene was destroyed, so therefore, whatever caused that fire, requires an adverse inference against whoever destroyed it. What's the connection between the possibility, and as Your Honor pointed out, electrical or whatever, versus fault or an adverse inference of negligence against any party, whether it be Ferguson or Mesa? But even if Your Honor's question is answered yes, then what does that have to do with Mesa? Mesa had no opportunity to operate the pellet stove, didn't even know about the pellet stove. It is the insurer of Ferguson who again was the owner and operator of the structure. Mesa had nothing to do with that.
So your argument is there's no claim to state against the insurer. The insurer shouldn't have been sued here. Is that right?
That is
on correct. A negligence theory. Okay.
Yeah, that is correct. So you can draw any adverse inference you want, and I don't think you should, and I'll discuss that. But not against Mesa. Mesa's the insurer, not the building owner or operator. So the issues raised by the appellant here have nothing to do with connecting Mesa's liability or responsibility to the cause of the fire, because they weren't even on the scene. They had nothing to do with the premises whatsoever. And it was never argued in the motion for summary judgment, in the opposition to our motion for summary judgment, that Mesa could somehow be associated with fault and causing fire one way or another, whether it be an adverse inference or circumstantial.
Mr. Lulick, did your client at any time bring a Rule 12 motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim? If so, why not? Based on what your answer to Judge Smith's question here, it sounds like you ought to have been out completely early on in the matter.
Well, we were retained a little bit later on, Your Honor, to bring a motion for summary judgment, which we did. As soon as Mesa hired separate counsel, our first action was to bring a motion for summary judgment, and it was a little bit too late for Rule 12, but that would have been a good idea early on, yes. But that certainly doesn't prohibit any of the arguments I'm making here today as it relates to anything associated with Mesa's responsibility here. I would also like to address the allegations of that Mesa somehow prohibited Grinnell's investigation. And I think I want to repeat the chronology here that Mr. Waldeck discussed a little bit earlier. And that is, this fire occurred on March 11, 2018. The property wasn't destroyed. The scene wasn't destroyed until April 30th, 2018. It's about 50 days, members of the court. And for a fire scene to remain available to anyone to inspect for 50 days, and then have someone claim that they didn't have access to it is nonsensical. I don't want to tell war stories to the court, but I've been doing this a long time, and sometimes these scenes have to be investigated and abolished within days after the fire. This thing sat there for 50 days in downtown Mazapa for anyone to look at. Grinnell wasn't denied access. Grinnell insisted that Mesa be involved with it in a joint inspection and examination of the scene. we weren't interested in doing that. We don't have to do that. MESA is not required to do any investigation of the scene. MESA didn't hire an investigator. MESA didn't hire an expert in cause and origin of fires. MESA relied on two things. One, the fire marshal's decision, the cause of the fire was undetermined. And also, just looking at this thing, I mean, it looks like a war zone, members of the court. I mean, the place is just destroyed. And so they decided they weren't going to waste the time and money inspecting the fire scene because the juice, so to speak, just isn't worth the squeeze. And so that's the decision that MESA made. Grinnell wanted them to go back on that decision and help them investigate this scene. And I want to talk, in the little time I have left, about duty here. Is this court ready to state that there's a duty on behalf of an insurer such as MESA to preserve a fire scene for somebody like Grinnell so that its insured might be exposed to liability? What if that insured doesn't have proper limits? What if that insured has a big retention? What if it doesn't have any liability insurance whatsoever? There's no duty here. This is not a case involving a plaintiff bringing a cause of action and destroying the evidence that would prove it. This is a case involving destruction of evidence that needed to be destroyed and that no party had any duty to preserve for Grinnell. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lulick. And Mr. Giesen, you will now have 5 minutes of rebuttal and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I haven't heard anybody dispute yet that if an adverse inference is available, that it must be drawn. There's nobody arguing that
Mr. Giesen, can we just talk law for a second with regard to your request for an adverse inference? It looks to me like what you're arguing is that a Minnesota court, although there's no precedent, should be able in circumstances where it could draw an adverse inference to use that fact alone to overcome summary judgment. Is that what you're requesting?
Almost. I would say that we did rely on the Cronish decision at the district court and to this court, which it's not simply the adverse inference alone. It's not that you can use the adverse inference to hold all the water, but it is available to plug holes.
So based on that fact alone, a district court could deny summary judgment and send something to the jury if there could possibly be an adverse inference drawn.
I think the general rule is that if there is a reasonable inference available, yes, it must be sent to the jury. It's a separation of powers.
And that theory or argument would apply even if there were no other circumstances suggesting negligence, just the adverse inference alone.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. I think that's where you have to, there isn't a Minnesota case precisely on point, but the weight of authority here in other jurisdictions, I think, is fairly represented by that Cronish decision. That, you know, you can't use the adverse inference as a fig leaf for having absolutely no evidence. But that's not what's happened here. Selective targeted the pellet stove as the possible cause of this fire after determining the fire originated from the immediate area of the pellet stove. So this isn't a case where there's absolutely no evidence or we're grasping at straws. We're grasping at the same thing Selective was grasping at when they were doing their own investigation. So this isn't a case where there's absolutely no evidence. This is a case like in Cronish, where there's an embryo or like a bud. Maybe the evidence is not in full blossom and we don't have all the evidence we would have liked to have, but it's there. So I think with that caveat, I think I would agree with you that yes, if there is a reasonable adverse inference available, the failure to grant it is reversible error.
Now, Mr. Giesen, just to clarify the answer to Judge Aidis's question though, a possible source of a fire, that's still insufficient, is it not, to a possible negligence cause of a fire? In other words, fires can happen all the time, of course, and it could be a furnace, it could be a, you know, gas related, it could be electrical related, none of which would lead you to more than a fig leaf to be able to allow an inference. You'd have to have the actual breach of a duty that caused the fire, at least some evidence of that, to then perhaps bridge the gap and have the adverse inference to proceed to trial.
And I would agree with that. And I would say that we have Selective's own investigation where they ruled out an electrical fire. They ruled out that the fire originated from the area of the furnace or from the kitchen area. So we do have more than nothing. We have their own investigation showing that this is the likely cause. And the state fire investigator, they told Selective to reach out to Grinnell. The state and fire investigator does not have the resources to dig out the fire scene. Grinnell does. And they wanted to.
Following up, Mr. Gieson, on Judge Sluder's question, I think it, as I understand it, the question is, yes, okay, let's assume the fire originated in the stove. What is your evidence of negligence concerning the stove? Because the stove, that doesn't tell us anything to say where it started, to say whether it started because of negligence, as opposed to a product defect or something.
Unfortunately, because the evidence was destroyed, the fire scene was destroyed before we had a chance to get to it, and we didn't have the complete stove in the place where it was, we don't have the exact answers that we would like to present to a jury.
The stove had been moved?
Yes, it had been in the fire scene, which got dug around with a payloader. And it wasn't just a marble bench. It was scrap metal. This is not really a question of law that's being argued here.
Let me just clarify. So with regard to the stove being moved, what is the evidence? Isn't the evidence that the stove fell into the basement during the fire? Or am I mistaken about that?
The evidence is that Selective instructed their insured that he was free to destroy the property if he wanted to. And afterwards, dug through the fire scene with a payloader. And that our investigator, when he was allowed to go...
Where was the stove when Grinnell went to the scene at the outset?
I believe it was in pieces scattered. So I see my time has expired here. I would just urge the court to enforce the standard review here and not allow factual questions that are better presented to a jury. Let that be the basis for affirming summary judgment. And with that, I would ask the court to reverse.
Very well. Thank you to all counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing, and we will take the matter under advisement. And the order will be issued within 90 days. You all have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Thank you.